Hey there, are you sitting down? Good, because Wayfair's end of season sale is here and you can shop it from your couch. It's Wayfair's Labor Day clearance and it's on now. Right now, you can score up to 70% off everything home at Wayfair, like up to 50% off outdoor furniture and decor, and up to 70% off area rugs, plus amazing doorbuster deals and 24-hour surprise flash deals on Wayfair home finds in every style. And get it all with fast shipping on everything right to your door. From furniture to faucets, this is your last chance of the season to score huge deals at Wayfair. Don't let the final days of summer pass you by without shopping these end-of-season savings. So don't wait. Like summer, these savings won't last. Head to Wayfair.com today to score up to 70% off everything home. Celebrate your holiday weekend with can't-miss savings before they run out. Shop Wayfair's Labor Day clearance now through September 2nd at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
And the worms crawl in, the worms crawl out. They'll eat your guts and spit them out. And when your bones begin to rot, the worms remain, but you do not. So don't ever laugh as a hearse goes by, for someday you'll be next in line. And when death brings his cold despair, ask yourself, will anyone care?
Macabre may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
We are back for part two of the A is for Amityville interview. We are kicking it off. We're diving right in to the investigation and the seance.
Have fun.
Lorraine said she could really sense blood all over the place. Now, that's not a big stretch. You and I could walk in and say the same thing if we were making it up. But the point is, she didn't know the layout or who had been where. There was only one room in the house where she felt comfortable. But she got to a certain point on the stair landing towards the second floor where she really felt ill. When we proceeded to the third floor, I was right behind her. And she was walking into what had been Ronnie DeFeo Jr.'s bedroom, but she didn't know that. She stopped abruptly and said, I can't go into this room.
Wow.
I just have a really, there's a really oppressive, heavy feeling of evil. I can't go into this room. So we left, we went down to the basement. As we were going through, Ed had his crucifix and he was leading the way. And he says, if there's any evil here, in the name of Jesus Christ, I command you to leave, etc. And again, Lorraine was recording her impressions. And at the end of it, she basically said, wow, this is really, you know, just a heavy feeling. And so we shot all of that film. We agreed that the next steps were going to be to have a seance to try and rid the house of whatever evil was there or make contact. Unbeknownst to us, the Lutzes, when we told them, George Lutz had invited a number of people to go in.
Oh, wow. That's kind of surprising.
The Warrens had invited a number of people to go in. From the first broadcast on February 23rd, between then and March 6th, that 2 weeks, I had introduced Ed and Lorraine Warren to George and Kathy Lutz. So Ed started to ask George Lutz, well, what happened? Tell me about it. And, you know, George was reluctant. Again, it was like pulling teeth to get George to really provide details. And Ed got angry and they had a confrontation. And I'm sitting there. And basically, Kathy Lutz and Ed and Lorraine Warren had to get between these two men.
Oh, no.
Because, well, Ed said, look, if you're not going to cooperate with us, we're not going to be able to help you.
That kind of response, it would make you wonder, as someone who is legitimately trying to investigate, like, is this person withholding information because they're not being truthful, or are they withholding information because they're afraid and they don't want to talk about it? So trying to discern between the two.
But it's like,
know,
talking, if you're talking to a doctor or a psychiatrist or a trainer, a teacher, you have to tell them certain things.
Right.
And George, even at that point, as I said, he was very tightly wound, very high strung individual. Okay. It was sort of like a tensile wire. You thought at any moment he could snap. And so in that 2 weeks, from February 23rd until the actual seance on March 6th, George was making a lot of demands behind the scenes. He wanted this, he wanted that. We weren't supposed to, trying to make up rules. And I remember Steve saying, well, we'll be nice to him and cooperate with him as much as we can because we're getting this exclusive. But we're not going to allow him to dictate and impinge on our journalistic integrity. So I was the sort of go-between, and I was biting my nails. I'm saying, oh my God, I hope this comes off. Well, we didn't know that Ed and Lorraine, they had their own photographer come. They had a couple of other assistants come. Our news director invited another reporter with the radio station, Mike Linder. George Lutz had invited researchers who were loosely affiliated, although they did not officially work for Duke University. There was something called the Dream Lab at that point. And he also invited some other psychics, Dr. Osis and Dr. Alex Tanis from the New York Institute for Psychical Research. There were 21 people in the house that night. And I had no idea that all of these people were going to show up. So when I actually got to the house that Saturday night, it was funny because you go in through the side door and there are side lights, you know, windows alongside the door. And I was just about to put the key in the door and I see this face looking at me.
Nope.
And it's like this hawk nose and these big dark eyes with dark circles. I almost jumped right off the doorstep because it was scary. It almost looked like a vampire. It was Dr. Alex Tanis. So the house was lit from top to bottom. There's like 22 people. We're waiting for everybody to arrive. I see there's a house full of people. Who are all these people?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it was very funny. So the house was lit up. There was like this party atmosphere. Marvin arrived with the crew. Again, it was not scripted. There is no one executive producer. No one is in charge.
Oh.
And the Lutzes were not there, but they had invited all of these people. And one of the, there were some graduate students who were working with the person from Duke University. And these kids were really, they were probably, you know, a couple of years older than me, but they were really stupid. They went up to Ed, I mean, they were really acting dumb. They went up to Ed Warren and said, have you ever seen a ghost? Now, if you're a graduate student, you know, and you're at Duke University, you would expect something a little, wasn't so middle school or kindergarten. And they were really annoying. He sent them off to the basement. One thing that happened that was actually pretty funny was the doorbell rang. Oh, a bunch of people went out to get some food. So again, people were just sort of walking around and a bunch of people went out to get some food. And in the middle of all this, the doorbell rings. And it's some high school kid who was looking for his prom date. It was kind of funny. Don't ask me, you know. So then finally we got underway. And I remember our cameraman, Steve Petropoulos, he was one of, we had five crews at Channel 5 and he was like the fifth crew. He was one of our regular stringers. He was from New Jersey and he was about 40, 38, 40 years old. about 5'9", 5'10", slim. He used to run marathons. In those days, the camera equipment mm-hmm. was very heavy. The cameras were much physically bigger, bulkier, and heavy. So what I'm getting at is you had to be in good shape to be a television right. newsman, a cameraman, because you were running, you might be covering demonstrations, riots, you might be trying to get a shot of, mm-hmm. a president, a Broadway actor, and right. you had to move fast. So you had to be exactly. fit and in shape. So Steve was taking light readings. He had his light meter, and he starts to walk up the center staircase from the first floor mm-hmm. to the second floor. He got halfway up the stairs, and I was at the bottom of the staircase. And he turns around. He didn't have the camera equipment. He just had his light meter. And he turns around, and he looks at me very quizzically, and he said, you know, the second bedroom on the left, on the second floor, that room has one wall that's filled with mirrors. That was the master bedroom. And if you've mm-hmm. ever been to Vegas, you know, you go into some of those hotels, they'll have the wall, the 12 by 12 mirrors mm-hmm. with the gold stuff on them. That was what was on one wall of the master bedroom.
Oh. And he...
And he says, and he looks at me, and he had never been in the house before. He had just gotten there. He had never, and it hadn't been published mm-hmm. in the papers. So he had no way of knowing this. And he said to me, and he looked really puzzled. He says, I don't know how I knew that. I don't know how I know that. Okay, because he hadn't even been in the room yet. He had just arrived. He continued up the stairs, gets to the second floor landing, mm-hmm. the same spot where Lorraine had felt ill. And he turns around and he looks at me. And I notice all the color drains from his face.
Oh.
And he breaks out into a sweat and he doubles over and he's clutching his chest. So our electrician and our sound guy rush up to bring him downstairs. Mm-hmm. They sit him on the bottom step and they get him some water. He had had heart palpitations, really severe heart palpitations. So it seemed to pass after a few minutes and he was okay. And he says, I've never had this happen to me before. I don't know what happened. And by the way, you can't fake your face, you know, the blood draining out of your face.
Oh, no.
To a cold sweat.
I've actually had that happen to me before. I've had like a major, incident mm-hmm. with heart palpitations, and it almost knocked me unconscious. Ooh. That's how bad it was.
And what precipitated it? What brought it on?
It was stress. It was stress. It was panic. But I'm also one of those people that's very sensitive to energy in a way that like I can be around people that I've never met and like know that I don't want to be around them. You know, you get that feeling of you get that feeling of dread or panic. So it sounds almost like maybe this was something he was picking up on.
Well, if he was picking up on it, he was picking up on it unconsciously.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because,
yes.
You know, he said, I've never had that happen before. And this is a seasoned cameraman, a seasoned news mm-hmm. person. And he was not in any, he hadn't been physically active before. It's not like he went out and ran 3 miles and came in. So he was puzzled. It passed. So that was the first thing. Then we decided we would walk around, you know, the house, go through the rooms again. We did that. And then we were going mm-hmm. to have the seance. And as I said, Ed and Lorraine Warren had brought several psychic friends of theirs with them, whom I had never met before. So we sit down and we've got all of these people at the Lutz's dining mm-hmm. room table. And I'm sitting between Marvin Scott on my right and Mark Linder from WNEW Radio mm-hmm. on my left. And we're in a sort of darkened room, you know, low lights. Lorraine is at one end of the table. And she's going into a light trance. And for anyone not familiar with what the difference between a light trance medium and a full trance medium goes into a trance. They're not aware of things. So it's like as if you were being hypnotized. You're not going to mm-hmm. remember it, you know, necessarily. Lorraine was always conscious.
Okay.
And she was giving her impressions. Ed was asking her questions. So we start the seance, and Lorraine is giving her impressions, and Marvin Scott, to my right, leans over and he says, "Hey, I just felt a chill." Like this, very urgently. Like, I didn't feel anything. 5 minutes later, Mike Linder, who was, by the way, both Marvin Scott and Mike Linder were very skeptical. Across the table from me, Alberta Riley, who's this lovely woman, she's got long blonde hair. She suddenly yells out, "It's upstairs in the second floor."
Oh, no.
And yeah, it's moving.
Did you hear anything?
No. Huh. Whatever it was, I guess it was, again, an unseen force. It wasn't a physical presence. Then the next thing I knew was Mary Pascarella, another psychic who was there. She was a woman who could read auras. She jumps up, runs out of the room, out of the house, actually, and was physically nauseous, was vomiting outside on the lawn. So around this time, I'm thinking to myself, how come I don't? Everybody's screaming. This one's having heart palpitations. Somebody else has a chill. Somebody else is physically nauseous. They have to leave the room. I don't feel anything. And what Lorraine was saying was that whatever was in the house, the impression she got was that it was not of this earth. It had not been, it wasn't a departed spirit. It was not a ghost, that it was demonic. And she said that there would be a priest that would come and he would be the one that would be able to cleanse the house. After the seance broke up, again, it was sort of, okay, well, what do we do next? It was sort of chaotic. So people were going into different rooms. And Marvin said to me, "Listen, I know that the station is willing to devote a lot of time to this, but I don't feel like we have it." By it, what he was referring to was you wanted something like The Exorcist. Right. Or Poltergeist on tape.
Something big.
Some physical manifestation. Was the table going to raise up off the floor?
Yeah, and they wanted a spectacle to show on TV.
And look, if one believes in the supernatural, the paranormal, if you believe in ghosts, demons, hauntings, then you know they are not actors or actresses. This is not a Broadway show where they are putting on a performance. If you don't believe in this, if you don't believe in any of this, then best case scenario, you think that people are have spooked themselves or are delusional. Worst case scenario, you think that they're making it up and acting. It sort of went on and meandered, and we went upstairs with the crew, and we brought Lorraine upstairs into the sewing room to give her impressions. But truthfully, you know, and we had a candle there. It was like talking to somebody in a dark room. A lot of the spooky stuff, to me, the spookiest thing was what had happened that night, was what had happened to Steve Petropoulos.
Yeah, definitely. That is scary.
But the house, and then around 10:30, 11 o'clock at night after we had, you know, had the seance. Again, people were milling around as though it were a party. They were going into the liquor cabinet, so it really was a party then. But with all that was going on, and we went down into the basement, and I've heard stories since then that Ed went down into the basement with the crucifix and was confronted by a legion of demons. Well, I was right behind him. I never saw any or heard any legion of demons. So as the years have gone on, this story increases with the telling, and it gets, there's a lot of hyperbole involved.
That when the picture was taken, the infamous picture of the boy.
The ghost boy photo, I cannot tell you whether or not it was faked. I can't tell you whether it's the genuine thing, because I was not there when the film was developed. My role was as an investigator, a reporter, a producer, to report on what I saw and heard and experienced. I felt like I must have all the sensitivity of a rock, because I'm watching Marvin Scott, Mike Linder say they have chills. I'm sitting in between them. I didn't feel a thing. So one could put that down to the fact that I was just hot-blooded. I'm watching psychics get sick. I'm watching my the cameraman have heart palpitations. Nothing is happening to me. I don't feel anything. I don't sense anything.
What was going through your head at that point, now that you're you've seen multiple people at the table go through something and you're like, what the heck, guys? Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think it's like a collective sort of experience that's almost like a hallucination or a physical manifestation? Or do you think there's a chance that it's real? I mean, it is real because it happened, right? Especially like the palpitations and seeing the physical outcome of that. But yeah, what was your kind of your thought?
Well, my first thought, the first visceral reaction I had was, I guess I'm not good enough to haunt. Or for them, nothing wanted to bother with me.
Or you're very lucky. Okay. Yeah. And the relics were working.
Yeah. Or yes. Yes.
Well, I mean, you know. But the second thought was we needed to get something good on film.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel like we had anything definitive. Like you wanted to be able to... Television is a visual medium. Okay, so you wanted to be able to see something. So nobody saw or heard Marvin and Mike Linder saying, hey, I just felt a chill. And the psychic screaming and getting ill, that didn't make it on things. So what we had on film was Lorraine giving her impressions, sitting around a dining room table in a dark room doing this seance, but not... You weren't seeing anything. You didn't hear any strange noises. You didn't hear any table tapping. Nothing fell off a shelf to scare people. We didn't get the cameraman having his heart palpitations. So finally, by about 3:34 in the morning, Ed Warren called a halt to the proceedings and said, look, nothing's going to happen here. We need to give the house a chance to quiet down. So people were leaving. Unbeknownst to me, Mike Linder went upstairs to the second or third floor to go to sleep in one of the bedrooms. He woke up the next morning and he was alone in the house.
Oh no.
He was That'd waiting be scary. To see if anything would happen. Okay. But one of the funniest things that happened, which unfortunately we did not, get on tape, as we were leaving, there's a shared driveway. So the Channel 5 film crew was packing up all the gear. We were talking, standing in the driveway, talking to Ed and Lorraine Warren. And Ed says, we'll have to try and come back and, maybe do something and, at another time. Just then, our lighting and our film crew had some of the equipment, which was in the big cases, was like 1 foot over into the other person's yard. Just then, the next door neighbors came home, the Ireland's, the husband and wife. And they go into, they're looking at us, they're giving us an evil glare. They go into the house. The next thing you know, 10 minutes later, a police car shows. And so the cops, it's from the Amityville Police Department, they come out and they said, oh, who are you guys? So Marvin Scott says, well, we're from Channel 5. We have permission to be here, etc. Well, could you show us your ID? So Marvin didn't have his press credentials on him. So a little lowly news assistant who actually had to show the press credential. So at that point, the cops start telling us this house is just like one big disaster. It's a pain in the neck, using stronger language, of course. We have to patrol here all the time. People are showing up on boats to try and get into the house from the river. They're, tour buses are coming by. So they were not happy. This was their quiet town. And suddenly you've got an amusement park attraction. Yeah. Well, as the cops are complaining to us bitterly about this, and again, it's like 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, here comes the next door neighbor, totally inebriated. She starts running up and down the driveway, yelling, woohoo, Ronnie, you want to come out and play guns?
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
That was the biggest spectacle of the night. And unfortunately, the camera equipment had already been put away. That was the worst on camera. I mean, today,
a drunk neighbor.
Today, I would just whip out my...
The cell phone,
the mobile phone. Yeah. I said to the cops, I said, you're worried about us? Look at that. And by the way, to your point earlier, why didn't anybody hear anything when the murders were committed? So the neighbors were questioned. Everybody claimed that they heard nothing, including Mrs. Ireland, who over the years changed her story. Later on, at some unspecified date, I'm not sure when, she claimed that she had heard some noises. In fact, at the time, the only one who claimed they heard anything the night of the DeFeo murders was two doors down in the other direction, because the house right next to the DeFeo's was unoccupied at the time. But there was a 15-year-old boy who had heard Shaggy the dog, who was tied outside in the backyard, barking at the time that coincided with Ronnie shooting his family. So the dog was barking. A couple of weeks after the seance, I wanted to go into the house on my own to see, just to see if I felt anything.
Right.
I was curious. And I went in on a Saturday afternoon. I was also going out there to bring back their house keys. And they didn't know I was going to go into the house first. So I went out in the middle of the afternoon. I had my dog Fritz with me, who was a German Shepherd Lab mix. Very, very nice dog. Very perceptive. If he were alive today, this is one of the dogs that would probably be able to sense when somebody was having a seizure, a fit. He was very, very perceptive that way. Anyway, so I went into the house with Fritz. I just left him in the foyer. He wasn't going to go, you know, wasn't going to go anywhere. And I was just walking around the house. And again, all the furniture was still there. All of a sudden I hear a noise. I hear the dog growling.
Oh.
So I was in the back, towards the back of the house, you know, towards the sunroom. So I go walking again into the foyer, the right by the door, and I see my dog standing there, stock still. His ears were pinned back. The hackles were up on his back from his neck to his tail.
Oh.
And he had a fixed stare, and it was at that same spot on the second floor landing where all these things had happened, where everybody, you know, seemingly got ill. And the dog isn't moving and he's growling. He's got his teeth bared, the ears. And I'm looking and he's looking, a fixed stare. He's looking at something and I don't see a damn thing. I didn't hear anything, no squirrels in the attic, nobody, you know, running around in the house. Because if that had been the case, he was a very protective dog. He was gentle, but he was protected. And I had never seen, he was five at the time. I had never seen the dog act like this. Up until that point, I never saw him act like that again. I started to go up the stairs. And then I thought, you know, Laura, this is probably not a good idea. Number one, you're not supposed to be here. So people might, you know, your car is in the driveway, but you're not supposed to be in this house. Number two, the dog's reaction, because nobody told the dog, six people have been violently killed in this house.
Well, and animals are so perceptive. So,
and
you know,
I started to think, number three, there's the possibility if you go up these stairs that you might mess with something or something might decide you're trying to mess with it and mess with you back. So I said, okay, I'm not, you remember all those horror movies of the 50s and the 40s? You always had somebody going to try and stake the vampire just before Sunday. Or you had somebody, it was always a damsel in distress running from the monster in the woods or the swamp in high heels. So I said, don't be that person. So, so I turned chicken and I said, time for me to leave.
Yeah.
And I didn't talk about that for a long time after that. But in the interim, the Lutzes moved to San Diego. They sent their tapes that they had made. They had made a lot of tapes to Prentice Hall. They got a book deal. Jay Anson wrote the book. And he said it was based on a true story. And he amplified and exaggerated many of the things. It got to the point where in the original book, Jay Anson had said that he attributed quotes to Steve Bauman and Marvin Scott, saying that this was the most haunted place they had ever been in. And they were threatening to sue him at the time. They never said that. And there was a lot of stuff. I mean, George Lutz used to talk about, he saw what he called, these are his words, not mine, green slime that he referred to as poltergeist puke.
Walls and the
I
the
never
door.
Saw that. It might have been mold. I didn't see any blood or any black substance coming from any of this, the faucets in the sink. again. Now, objectively, the things that impressed me the most, personally, were what I witnessed with our cameraman, Steve Petropoulos, and what I witnessed with my with my dog. You know, now I felt like Ed and Lorraine were very honest people, but nothing really happened. They didn't solve anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the thing. And when you see any of these things, like the movie The Conjuring, there's always a beginning, a middle, and an end. And by the way, I am not criticizing Ed and Lorraine. They just, you know, she gave her perceptions. Ed did what he did. Lorraine, for the record, always maintained that Amityville, and I'm sure you've heard this quote, was as close to hell as she ever wanted to get. She thought that that was scarier than the Conjuring House. Now, I will tell you a very odd thing that happened. This is years later. I'm up here in my office, sitting here at my desk. This was May 6th, 2006. And I was writing a report, and I'm writing away, and I'm deep into it. And all of a sudden, the thought comes into my head, I have to call Lorraine Warren. Not like, oh, you know, I haven't talked to my friend Mary for a while. I really have to give her a call. No, I hadn't talked to Lorraine at that point in about a year. I did keep in touch with the Warrens over the years. We maintained our friendship. But it was, I have to call Lorraine Warren. And it was like, right now. So I stopped what I was doing. My phone was right here, my landline at my desk. I dialed Lorraine. She picked up the phone. I said, Lorraine, it's Laura DiDio. Laura, hi, how are you? I said, I'm good. How are you doing? I said, fine. I said, you know, it's the funniest thing. I said, you just popped into my mind and I had a real urge to call you. We spent the next 2 hours on the phone. At that point, Ed was bedridden. Oh. He had a stroke and he never fully recovered from it. And he had been in a nursing home, but they brought him home. So Lorraine was, and they had, you know, visiting nurses coming in, and Lorraine was also caring. And she says, but I understand what he wants. I can communicate with him, even though he had lost the power of speech. So obviously we talked about a lot of things, including Amityville. And I remember asking her, I said, Lorraine, of all the cases that you've done, you know, because I had been in the Conjuring House. Ironically, would you believe I live 17 miles from the so-called Conjuring House. Yes. It's only 20 minutes away from me.
Yeah. Well, I didn't tell you this, Blair, but when Laura and I last spoke on the phone, I said, well, because I have friends in Connecticut, I said, maybe I need to get up there and make a visit at some point. Since it's not too far.
Yeah, you should. Well, if you can, you can stay with me if you like.
Yeah, that'd be amazing.
You know, as I said, it's open to the public now. Now they have people, they rent it out and have people coming in to do events. But Laura, I would have thought that maybe it was the Conjuring House or one of the other things in Connecticut. And she's, no, the Amityville thing. So we talked about a lot of things. And obviously, you know, the shared experiences, you know, in Amityville and et cetera. So I said, you know, Lorraine, I'll come down. We should go out to lunch. I'll come down to you. So let's do something in the next couple of weeks. So she's, okay, fine. So we've been on the phone for 2 hours. We hung up the phone. It was good to talk to her. Well, later that night, I'm online getting my emails, and the story breaks that George Lutz had died of a massive heart attack.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow.
Oh, I just got full body goosebumps.
Out in Las Vegas. So I said, at the very time that I had been on the phone with Lorraine.
So the see, next day, you, I call Lorraine. You do have said, some, you do have some psychic abilities and some.
You've got the intuition.
You're not immune.
No. Yeah. Well, what had happened was I called Lorraine the next day and I said, Lorraine, have you heard the news about George Lutz? And she's, yep. And I said, we were on the phone talking at the exact time he was having that fatal heart attack. and died. She says, I know. She was not at all surprised by this. And I said, Lorraine, I swear to you, you had popped into my mind. And I sat here and I said, I have to call Lorraine. And it was a compulsion. Mm-hmm. I have to do it right now. And she says, It reminded me of when we were in the phone booth. That was the other strange thing.
Yeah.
When we were in the phone booth trying to call George Lutz for the original filming. Over the years, there have been many people who have found and initiated projects debunking it. There's a cottage industry out of debunking this. And they make money and fame and, by doing that, as there are people who are, writing about it. Now, you're now on the third generation, of people talking about this. Many of the principals, George and Kathy Lutz, have passed away. Ed and Lorraine Warren are gone. And yet, I can never really fathom why this story, the interest in it, is as avid today as it was 45 years ago. And of course, part of it, although not all of it, is because of the continuing books, movies, documentaries that you see on streaming channels.
There's no shortage. Yeah. There's no shortage of content online. It will endure, I think. And people just still have questions about, was there any influence from the demonic that played a role in the DeFeo murders? And then obviously when something traumatic and tragic happens like that, if you believe in the paranormal, there's a good chance that something, an event of that scale, will leave behind some energy, some negative energy. And that may be what was being experienced by the people that were there to investigate. I'm curious, Laura, after considering everything that happened, what are your thoughts on that? Do you feel that maybe there was something that could have influenced the murders, or was it just simply the mental health issue, possibly the drugs, the angst in the family? Right.
There were many things that factored into it for both the DeFeos, the Lutzes, and other people. Now, I don't know what Ronnie DeFeo's particular diagnosis or pathology is. What we do know is he was on drugs. He was heavily influenced for that. We also know that he never expressed remorse. He continued. He's a pathological liar. He changed his story like the rest of us change our underwear. Okay, so he is not what you would call a reliable source by any stretch of the imagination. So if you don't believe in anything paranormal or the occult, then you're just going to say, look, he was a drug addicted kid, not very bright, who was very entitled. And ostensibly, he was high on drugs. So maybe he didn't need any other motive than he didn't like his father. But why kill all the other everyone family else. Members?
Yeah.
Okay. He was out of his mind on, he was high. However, if you do believe in the paranormal and the occult and the possibility of it, then you know that somebody who is on drugs, they're surrendering a part of their consciousness. So they are ripe to be exploited or have an infestation. Certainly he came from, you cannot discount the fact that the DeFeos were a Catholic family. And going back 50 years ago, as a society, we were much less secular than we are today. And religion certainly was a big part of their family. Okay, on the witness stand, Michael Briganti Sr., Louise Briganti DeFeo's father, made a point of saying he was a practicing Catholic and took communion once a month. There were holy statues, saint statues on the front lawn in the house. So Ronnie went to Catholic school. And one of the things he was very proud of saying was that he never hit a sister, meaning a nun. So whether or not he was actually possessed, he had that belief. So there is the potential yes, that all played into it. And he did on the stand, he was trying to play up, yeah, the devil made me do it. But part of that, you can't, he's not right. believable. But certainly there's the possibility of that. Now, the murders themselves were very gory. And there are pictures from the autopsies. He shot his siblings and his parents at close range. His one brother, he shot in the back, the youngest one. And it severed his spine. And he told the detectives that he stood there watching while the leg twitched. His two sisters, Allison and Dawn, 13 and 18, were shot at close range in the face. Now, there was blood all over. Now, I can tell you that once the cops had undesignated the house as a crime scene, neither the DeFeo nor the Briganti families went in there other than to get the furniture out. A lot of it they didn't get out because it was purchased by the DeFeo family, or rather by the Lutz family. But when Kathy went in there, she was still, she had to clean that house. She was scraping a year later, dried blood, bone, and body parts, you know, brain matter, whatever was left off the walls, off the floors. Now you start handling that.
That does a lot to you.
Of course. And not only that, there was some talk, and we don't know exactly what happened, but that Dawn might have been awake when he shot her. Again, you know, Ronnie is not reliable, but you've got four, when you go to any battlefield, Civil War battlefields, Revolutionary, well, you name it, when you have people who die a very unexpected and violent death, a lot of those spirits, again, if you believe in the paranormal, they don't necessarily know what's happened. They're confused. Have they crossed over? So there's some of that. And you don't know what you might absorb. If you believe in the supernatural, the paranormal, then I believe that remnants can be left behind. What do I personally think? I think something happened there. The fact that the DeFeos were murdered so violently, the Lutzes moved in a year later. I think something happened. Do I think everything that was said in the books and has written about and all this other stuff? No, there has been a lot of hyperbole. And the further away we get, the more the stories grow and people are confusing and conflating different events and incidents. But for myself, I think something happened. I think there was something there based on some of the things that I've described to you. I mean, I was surprised myself. I was shocked after talking to Lorraine that day, having the compulsion to call her out of the blue, and then finding out that night, story came over the wire. George Lutz had died. And I called Lorraine the next day. I said, I can't believe this.
That's unreal.
That I'm not making up. That really did happen. And I know that there will be people listening to this podcast who think Laura is making this up. Nope. The things with Steve Petropoulos, our cameraman, the thing with my dog. And then years later, wanting to call Lorraine and talking about it. And we were on the phone. Marvin Scott will tell you today, he doesn't call it a hoax, but he said, he'll say today, I felt a chill, a little chill, but that was it. Nothing happened. I don't think it was haunted.
Well, In my experience in being in paranormal places, not everybody does have the same experiences. So, people can make of it what they want, but I'm in the line of thinking that something definitely happened. Yeah. And when something that traumatic happens, it cannot not leave an impression in that household. So again,
exactly. It is not true that nobody else has experienced anything since the Lutzes moved out. There are
realtors
who have gone in there, who have left. They felt hinky. Now, whether or not it's the power of suggestion, you know, based on the house's history.
Right.
Who knows? But I am, what's amazing to me is how it endures. And it just never, the interest in this never wanes. In fact, if anything, it increases.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.